Do you want to fly somewhere? Anywhere in the world? Smart travelers call myflightsearch.com for the best deals on flight tickets. Going to Manila, Bangkok, London, how about Singapore? Call myflightsearch.com for the lowest flight tickets available. What about a local vacation? Let's say you want to fly to Vegas, Orlando, Miami, Los Angeles, or Denver. Pick up the phone and call myflightsearch.com right now. We have exclusive deals that you can't find anywhere else. The only way you can get these low airline prices is by calling us. We have so many low prices available, we can't possibly tell them to you right here and now. If you're flying somewhere anytime in the next 6 months and you want the lowest airline ticket prices anywhere, you owe it to yourself to save a ton of money. So pick up your cell phone and call myflightsearch.com right now.
Call 800-303-3398. 800-303-3398. That's 800-303-3398. Call now. 800-303-3398.
From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. Reforming Dodd-Frank financial regulations, that's today on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Charles Calamiris is the Henry Kaufman Professor of Financial Institutions at the Columbia Business School. His research spans the areas of banking, corporate finance, financial history, and monetary economics. He's a distinguished visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution and a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. And his new book out, Reforming Financial Regulation After Dodd-Frank. Welcome, Professor.
Oh, it's so great to be here, Jim. Thanks.
By the way, it must be a great honor to be have the chair of Dr. Doom, right, Henry Kaufman?
Henry is one of the finest gentlemen I know. He's a personal friend, and it's really just a great honor to be able to be associated with him.
All right. Dodd-Frank law, which I kind of call also the law of unintended consequences, is it failing? Is it a repeal and replace or a tune-up situation?
I'm sorry to say that I think on some dimensions it's just a repeal and replace or just repeal on some, and on other things I guess I would call it a tune-up. So it's a mix because, after all, you know, this thing was 2,000 pages long. We've had, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of rules that have been written on the basis of it. It's one of the most far-reaching sets of regulatory proposals that we've had ever in U.S. history. And so, it's, you know, and it happened in the wake of a crisis inspired as much by intense anger and you might even say hatred as by reasoning and done very, very quickly. And so it would be a miracle if it weren't in need of major changes, and it is.
Would Dodd-Frank avert a financial crisis in any event? Is it possible to regulate crises?
Well, I don't think in its current form it would. It's not possible to ever say that we're going to, you know, avoid having a financial crisis. But here's the thing that we can avoid. We can avoid having a banking crisis, a banking system crisis, where whatever shocks happen in the markets is magnified by the collapse of the banking system. How do we know that we can avoid it? Because there are countries that have economies that are riskier than ours that have never had a banking crisis.
Canada,
exactly. So Canada is an example of exactly that. And so we can learn a lot from countries like that. And what we learn is, and this is a fairly controversial statement, but I think it's historically can be demonstrated, having banking crises is a political decision. That is, if you want to have your banking system stable enough and able to support growth and lending, you can do it. But it requires depoliticizing your banking system. So I think, we can avoid having all financial crises, of course, but we can avoid having a banking system that's vulnerable to collapse as a result of financial shocks. But that's not something the U.S. has ever chosen. We have the most of developed economies in the world, we have the most unstable banking system history of any of them. We've had 17 major banking crises in our history.
Wow. Have we fixed TBTF too big to fail?
No. So what we did, a couple of things in Dodd-Frank that sound good but are unworkable and won't fix it. the two major ones, and we can go into it in more detail, that I would say are related to that is, number one, the Title II of Dodd-Frank, which is all about how we would liquidate a big bank or non-bank institution like an investment bank or an insurance company if it got into trouble, so we would be able to liquidate them rather than bail them out. I would say that's not true. What really we do in Title II is we have institutionalized the mechanism for bailing them out if we decide we don't want to liquidate them, and we most assuredly will decide that it's unworkable to liquidate them. The second thing is these living wills that have to be created, where the institutions have to describe and plan in advance their own demise and liquidation. Well, that's a good planning device because it makes them have to just look in the mirror and come to grips with themselves. But again, it's not going to lead to a credible, practical plan for liquidation. I could, you know, explain why. So really what we have to do is we have to focus on keeping the too-big-to-fail institutions far away from the insolvency point. That is, as long as you're never close to being insolvent, you know, we don't have to worry about liquidating you. And I think that's really where we have to go. And I think Dodd-Frank didn't do us any favors by pretending that we could just solve this problem by having a plan for how we're going to liquidate them. The plans aren't workable, and it's really unrealistic to think we're going to do that.
Has the regulatory burden from Dodd-Frank, has it turned banks into utilities? And I think you mentioned in your book, one of the unintended consequences is small banks have been wounded by this act.
All three, yes. So I think to some extent things like the Volcker Rule have stripped banks of some of the activities that might be value-creating for the banks and for society, yes. But I wouldn't say that they've turned them into utilities, meaning, you know, very limited kinds of regulated entities in terms of their activities. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that. Now, in terms of small, medium, and large banks, what's interesting is Dodd-Frank is hitting each category of banks in different ways. So small banks just really can't handle the overhead costs of having to comply with all these regulations, especially, you know, the Patriot Act and these other kinds of regulations. One of the things that's happened as a result of all the national security threats is regulation isn't just about prudential aspects, making banks safe, and it isn't just about consumer protection, making sure consumers aren't tricked. Financial regulation now is basically the government making the banks engage in law enforcement activities to take some of the burden off the government. And all of those kinds of regulations, if you're a small bank, the overhead costs of having to comply with them is just, you know, really insufferable. On the medium-sized banks, their problems are that if they grow, they trigger, based on their asset size, they trigger new compliance burdens. And so they actually are discouraged from engaging in acquisitions that might be very value-creating or even from growing past some thresholds. We have a $10 billion asset threshold and a $50 billion asset threshold. And academic research shows that banks that get close to those thresholds just freeze themselves and don't want to grow. And then, of course, for the big banks, they have huge new compliance burdens, not just higher capital requirements and higher liquidity requirements, but also stress tests and other such things. So each of the banks is really dealing with a different set of constraints that's creating different kinds of costs for them. I'm not saying that those costs are necessarily all a bad idea. We need some regulations. But the question is, are we getting what we want from them? That's the first question. Is the cost too big for the benefit? And the second question is, are the processes of these regulations consistent with rule of law in a democracy? And I think both of those are the big problems I'm having with the Dodd-Frank laws.
Wall Street's full of brilliant people, but there was no sense of systemic risk. The risk was all correlated. The whole thing almost went down. Has the FISOC, Financial Stability Oversight Council, has that helped fix that, or will it fix that?
I don't think it has. Again, I don't think that's a bad idea to have something like an FSOC looking ahead at things. In fact, some friends of mine, Jim Barth and Ross Levine and Jerry Capra, wrote a book about this before FSOC was created, and they proposed something called the Sentinel that would be an effective sort of forward-looking systemic risk monitor. I think it could be done quite effectively. The problem is it's located in the U.S. Treasury, and there's certain systemic risks that the Secretary of the Treasury is never going to want to identify. Let me point out, what is really the source of most systemic risk around the world today? It's real estate finance.
That was a fascinating insight, by the way.
Right, it's real estate. I mean, real estate is correlated with itself. It's correlated with the business cycle. It's a very illiquid asset, hard to liquidate in a downturn. The last thing you want to do is have banks who fund themselves with short-term debt,
yeah,
financing real estate development, which is very illiquid. And the problem is we have done that, not because it's a good economic idea, but because banks are what we control politically. So we real estate finance around the world is being subsidized by government for political reasons and using the banking system to do it. So, of course, systemic risk is really almost always about real estate, and that's the last thing these guys want to draw attention to. You know, I think that we need to have a much more independent authority from the government that's going to be a proper sentinel for this. But the government's pushing exactly the wrong direction, and we've already gotten sort of halfway back to the instability in the mortgage market that we were at, let's say, circa 2006.
We've only got about under a minute, but I want to do a consumer side unintended consequences. The Durbin Amendment was supposed to lower credit card fees, and it seems to have just netted out by adding other fees.
Well, that was for debit cards, and that's correct. So what happened is a study by people at the OFR and also the Federal Reserve Board found that the Durbin Amendment reduced fees by about $4 billion. It was targeted to certain classes of banks. Now, overdraft charges on checking accounts for those same customers went up exactly $4 billion. So all you did was have the money come from one pocket to the other.
And it increased essentially unbanked folks of more moderate income. So
that's true. You know, the percentage also of zero charge checking accounts fell from a number somewhere around 70% to somewhere around 35%. So we've really gone from and the number of people with access to banking services has actually also gone down in proportion. So yep, these costs are translating. The regulatory costs definitely are translating into reduced banking access, reduced credit.
You listen to Business Talk with Jim Campbell over the Biz Talk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. Coming next, principles to reform the financial regulations.
There's more than one way to invest in your education. Investing in the right products, securities, and real estate generates secure and sound futures. What about an investment that retains its value? Consider college real estate. College real estate can provide housing for students and generate returns for their families. Through this special offer from Austin iLabs, you can download the free workbook from collegerealestate.com to see if this investment is right for you. Go to collegerealestate.com/radio.
Do you owe $10,000 or more on at least two federal student loans? Then you may qualify for new programs offered by the Department of Education. These programs can reduce your interest, lower your payments, and possibly qualify you for loan forgiveness. If you have $10,000 or more and at least two federal student loans and currently not in school, you may qualify for one of these programs. Call now to check your eligibility. Student loan advisors are standing by to help you determine if you qualify for these new programs. They can help you reduce your interest, lower your payment, and even forgive a portion of your student loan debt. Take control of your financial future. Make this free 5-minute free call now to Nationwide Student Loans and learn how you can reduce your student loan debt.
800-439-1588. 800-439-1588. 800-439-1588. 800-439-1588.
Attention hernia mesh implant surgery patients. A popular hernia surgery product has been linked to a high rate of complications and injuries. If you or a loved one had a surgery where a hernia mesh was implanted and have experienced pain, infection, adhesions, mesh migration or product rejection, needed replacement or revision surgery, or other adverse reactions, you may be entitled to substantial financial compensation. Time is limited to file a claim. Call now for your free consultation. Call 800-706-6897. 800-706-6897. This is an advertisement. Paid non-attorney spokesperson. InjuryHelpDesk.com is responsible for this advertisement. Principal office, Las Vegas, Nevada.
National Funding Group has just released $100 million in easy access small business funding to businesses that gross at least $100,000 a year. You can have fast access up to $500,000 in new business capital in as little as 48 hours. Think about the ways you could grow your business if you had up to $500,000 cash infusion. Call a NFG funding expert now. The process is easy. It only takes about 5 minutes. Then our management-owned lending team looks at your application for a fast approval. You can get 100% funded in about 2 days. If you need up to $500,000 in working capital to run your business and you gross at least $100,000 a year, call NFG and apply today. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. That's 800-296-1564.
Are you married? Do you and your husband both have term life insurance? If you both don't, you should. You have a lot to protect. Call now, get a free quote for your husband, and while you're at it, get a quote for yourself too. Because you both need term life insurance. Call now. 800-915-9658. 800-915-9658. 800-915-9658. Rates are at all-time lows. We'll shop over 30 top-rated companies to get you the best possible rates. Term life insurance, it's the perfect way to protect the quality of your family's lifestyle. You and your husband both need term life insurance, so call now for a free quote for the both of you. 800-915-9658. 800-915-9658. 800-915-9658.
Biz Talk Radio.
Finance professor Charles Calamiris, and you've developed 10 principles to guide the specific reforms that come later, and we'll go through some of them. First, I want to start with rule of law. What you mean by that, and what's the difference between rulemaking and guidance?
So, rule of law is defined many ways, but let me say what I think is rule of law is as rule of law does, and you want to live in a world where the people who are under the law can predict how the law will be enforced and where the law is enforced in a way that's clear in advance and non-discriminatory. So that's what rule of law means, non-discriminatory, forecastable law that people are facing. Now, the difference between formal rulemaking and guidance is that guidance is often contrary to the rule of law because it's based on unspoken rules that are only articulated after the fact, so that somebody says to you, you know, Jim, here's my law for you. Don't do anything that's going to make me upset. And then after the fact, I say, well, sorry, Jim, you messed up. You made me upset, and it's going to cost you. Now, that's not rule of law. That's a kind of Kafka-esque regulatory environment, like Kafka's, you know, play The Trial. And that's where we are right now. I could give you several examples of it, but the key is you want to have, under the Administrative Procedures Act of 1946, our government articulated what rule of law means. It means that you set up rules, you have commentary in advance, you write down what the rules are, and then you enforce them according to what you've already discussed and what you've written down. Instead, guidance allows regulators to just say, well, we don't want you to do anything bad, and we'll let you know if you do. And that's not acceptable.
Financial objectives as a focus, and for instance, on the GSE subsidies and things, you're really talking about taking politics out and cost benefit pure in?
Well, certainly we need to find ways to depoliticize, especially the politics that comes with this kind of discretionary guidance. Let me give you an example of this that I think all of your listeners are going to find unbelievable. Something called Operation Choke Point.
Yeah.
Now, when you make, let's say, capital requirements for banks, they're a prudential requirement that makes banks have to hold sufficient amounts of buffer of capital so they don't go insolvent, limiting their leverage, basically. When you do that, you say, well, I'm going to tell you, Jim, after I see your circumstances, how much capital you need to keep. Okay, that might sound good. Yeah, good. Give them discretion because the regulators then can figure out, you know, better. But here's the problem. Then I say, well, you know, Jim, I noticed that, you know, the Attorney General told me that there are 30 activities that he doesn't like, called Operation Choke Point. This was an initiative. He doesn't like hate speech. He doesn't like pornography. He doesn't like lottery ticket sales. You know, whenever you are involved with those kinds of companies in your bank, letting them have checking accounts even, you're endangering your reputation risk. Why? Because I say so.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to make you hold a lot more capital if you're endangering your reputation risk. Now, that could be solved, though, Jim, if you'll just get rid of those customers. And by the way, you, Jim, aren't allowed to say publicly that I just had that conversation with you or that I have earmarked those 30 industries for your avoidance. Because if you do, you're violating the secrecy of the examination process. So what did I do? I used guidance that just said, oh, you have to have prudent capital requirements subject to my discretion as your examiner. And I'll let you know what they are. And then I say, oh, you know, here's a list of firms you need to avoid. That came from the Attorney General, Eric Holder, in 2012, 2013, and afterwards. And it actually was administered through our regulatory agencies. Now, that sounds like, again, a Franz Kafka play that was newly discovered. But in fact, that's the way our regulatory system is operating.
What do you mean by institutions should pay for their losses and in return they shouldn't be micromanaged by the government?
What I mean is that we need to keep, especially too-big-to-fail institutions, far from the insolvency point by establishing credible, transparent capital and liquidity requirements that keep them solvent. And so long as they're solvent, and we know that we have a credible means for keeping them off the public dole, then we shouldn't worry so much about things like whether we allow them to trade in certain securities or to be involved in certain activities. Because we don't have to, because we can rely on their own incentives and their own governance mechanisms internally to try to figure out how to measure risks and how to measure returns and decide which activities to do.
Let's do a little case study now between the rule of law and unintended consequences. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been deemed unconstitutional even in its structure. Talk about the CFPB.
Right. Well, as you point out, the courts have been pushing back both against the Financial Stability Oversight Council and against the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the CFPB is unique in that it, unlike, let's say, the SEC, which is a panel of people, you know, a commission of people from both parties who run it, the CFPB is run by one guy, its director. And he serves not at the pleasure of the president. So there's nobody who can fire him. He's one person. He has more dictatorial powers than anyone in the United States. Mm. Furthermore, his budget is completely under his own determination, and it's funded by the revenues earned by the Federal Reserve, so it's not part of the budgetary appropriation process. So imagine if I were one person in charge of all of consumer finance with my own budget so I could spend as much as I want. Can't be fired by the president. Can't be fired by anybody, really.
In the unintended consequences area, payday loans, for instance, which I would think, oh, those are bad things, they're usurious interest rates. But it turns out the folks that use that are very happy with the product who need it, and yet so that the actions by the CFPB were actually working against the folks that were using the loans.
And this is a great example of why we need to have formal rulemaking under the Administrative Procedures Act. Because this was done through Operation Choke Point, which I mentioned earlier, this process of, you know, having the Attorney General tell the bank regulators which activities to try to get rid of, and one of them was payday lending. If you had had a discussion of this under the Administrative Procedures Act, all of the academic research on payday lending would have come forward. People would have realized that actually, you know, the vast majority of the academic studies published in the best places have shown that payday lending is very, very good on balance for consumers. Now, it doesn't sound very good, you know, when you hear people are paying very high interest rates and all the rest of it. But the question is, what are their alternatives? And what exactly are the risks involved in this? How competitive is this industry? And it turns out it's pretty competitive and that the it's actually providing consumers a valuable service. But, you know, a lot of things don't sound very good on first pass, and later when you do the research, you find out that they're better than they sound. But if you do things through guidance in secret, through the sort of back door, you avoid all that commentary and all that discussion. Our democracy needs daylight. It needs discussion. It needs people to debate in a civil way out in the open. And the problem with Dodd-Frank, my biggest problem with it is that through all these new mechanisms, we've really gone in the other direction. So the thing that bothers me the most are the process problems that have arisen as a result of Dodd-Frank, more even than just the bad regulations or the ineffective regulations.
It's a good way to end this segment because we're going to talk about the specific reforms for financial regulations in our next segment.
Have you written a book and want to get it published? Then call Page Publishing ASAP. We're looking for authors of all types of books. And unlike most publishers, Page Publishing will take the time to review each and every book submitted to us. And we'll give you our feedback. And if we like what we read, we will get your book into bookstores and for sale online at Amazon, the Apple iTunes Store, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. We handle everything. Editing, cover design, copyright protection, printing, publicity, and distribution. So if you've written a novel, children's book, cookbook, inspirational work, poetry, or a biography and want to get it published, call Page Publishing now for your free author submission kit. Your road to fame and fortune could very well start with this simple phone call.
888-785-0618. 888-785-0618. 888-785-0618. That's 888-785-0618.
I owed the IRS $10,000.
The IRS garnished my wages.
They put a lien on my house.
The IRS is the most powerful collection agency in the world. They do not give up until you pay.
I couldn't sleep. We were being audited. I called Tax Solutions Now, and a great big weight was lifted off my shoulders.
I called Tax Solutions Now, and they got the IRS off my back.
Tax Solutions Now had my wage garnishment lifted in 48 hours.
Tax Solutions Now can get you help. Our agents know the rules, can stop the pain, and get you the best deal. We connect you with a team of former IRS agents and tax professionals who will get the IRS off your back.
We saved our home and overcame the most powerful collection agency in the world.
Call Tax Solutions Now. Time is running out.
Call 800-979-0166. 800-979-0166. 800-979-0166. 800-979-0166.
This alert just came in. This special announcement is for business owners and leaders of organizations who've been waiting for the right time to build. General Steel has made it impossible to wait any longer with rock-bottom prices that could save you thousands. That's right, General Steel, America's leader in pre-engineered structures, is offering buildings at prices you will never see again. Don't miss these prices. A 50 by 100 for under $30,000. You heard right. That's 5,000 square feet under $30,000. Manufacturers, if you need a larger building, try a 100 by 100 commercial building for $129,000. You can't afford to rent with these prices. Imagine a 70 by 100 foot church building for under $69,000. With the economy improving and interest rates still at historic lows, you can't afford to wait.
Call 800-605-5370. 800-605-5370. Call 800-605-5370.
Investing is a long-term process. How many times can you think of in the last decade that the stock market has destroyed retirement funds for people just like you and me? For your existing IRA, you need the security that gold has provided for centuries. Remember, gold has never been worth zero. Capital Gold would like to introduce you to the Home Storage Gold IRA. It's a self-directed IRA set up with all the protection and tax benefits of an LLC. But the big difference in this IRA is you invest in gold and you hold it in your possession. You can't do that with stocks. That's security. You can transfer any type of IRA hassle-free in days. Please call right now and learn more, and we'll waive the $500 setup fee and give you a free safe to store your gold. Call 800-223-0092. 800-223-0092. 800-223-0092. That's 800-223-0092.
Is getting a degree on your bucket list, but you've got a life, a job, family, stuff you can't put on hold to go back to school? Grantham University gets it. For over 65 years, Grantham's delivered affordable, relevant college and advanced degree programs to the men and women of our military. Let that sink in a moment. If they can deliver a quality education to a service member in a tent in Afghanistan, think about the flexibility Grantham can offer you so you can earn your degree too. Grantham is accredited and 100% online, so they're built to be flexible to make sure you can fit an education into your already busy life. Call Grantham today to find out how easy it is to get started on your education and check that college degree off your bucket list. Call Grantham right now, 800-910-0850. That's 800-910-0850. Grantham University, flexible, affordable, relevant. Call 800-910-0850.
Biz Talk Radio.
We're back with Charles Kalamiris. He's got a new book out, Reforming Financial Regulation After Dodd-Frank. Is it just an e-book, by the way?
It is an e-book. It exists in a hard copy. I had about 3,000 hard copies printed. Okay. But the only way that your listeners can get it is as a Kindle, as an e-book, for $1.
Yeah, it's a great bargain.
I made sure this. I didn't write this book to make money, as you can tell.
And by the way, you overstated it. It was 99 cents.
Okay.
All right, we're going to look at the specific reforms now, and I've kind of sliced them into the consumer, mortgage risk, and institutional. Let's start with proposed, and we'll flow from where we were. How would you like to see the CFPB restructure, like an SEC entity?
Right. I think, you know, it would make sense to have a commission. You know, alternatively, you could have a director just be part of the executive branch, serving at the pleasure of the president. But I think it makes sense to have it structured as a commission along the lines of the SEC. And I would also like to see it be part of the budgetary process, not be a part of the Fed. That's completely inappropriate. It should have to be that we decide as a country how much to spend on this agency like we decide to spend on everything else.
Briefly, tell people what the CARD Act is and why you'd repeal that.
So the CARD Act actually predated by a year the Dodd-Frank Act, and it was intended to limit interest rates and various perceived consumer abuses in the credit card industry. What research from researchers at the Federal Reserve Board has shown is that when the CARD Act was passed, because it limited interest rates that could be charged on risky credit card holders, it caused risky credit card holders to migrate away from the credit card industry into the shadow consumer finance industry, which makes sense. Whenever you say that, you know, I can't charge more for risk, then the people in the market are going to say, well, I'm not going to bear that risk. And so then somebody else who's not regulated through a product that's not a credit card is going to be the one who provides that service. That's exactly what's happened.
And you're for tax-favored housing savings accounts,
right,
and phasing, and that the portfolio loan portfolios could not be more than 25% commercial and residential.
Exactly. I want to get the banks out of the business of being too focused on real estate. So for most banks in the United States today, the average of their total real estate loans as a fraction of their loans is greater than 70%.
Wow.
Now that's, you know, if we went back 100 years, it was illegal for banks to have any real estate lending because it was considered inappropriate. Now, most banks in the United States, three-quarters of their lending is in real estate. We have to pare this back. Real estate can be funded through securitization. It can be funded through real estate investment trusts, insurance companies. Those were the traditional means of funding it. It only got into the banking system when we decided that we could use the banking system as a tool, or the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, as a tool to subsidize the risk. We need to get away from that subsidization of risk, and we need to free the banking system from this and free the taxpayers and make this our banking system something that makes sense again. We need to get real estate out of the banking system.
All right, let's go to the institutional side. Would you repeal the Volcker rule, and what about proprietary trading versus the other side of the house that has FDIC insurance, et cetera?
Right. So I am in favor of repealing the Volcker rule. I don't think the Volcker rule was inspired by any facts having to do with the crisis or anything else. I think it was just a hobby horse of Paul Volcker, and it based on no evidence. It's not, I think, the most important element of the plan, but I think it's right that once we prevent the banks from being a risk to the taxpayers through the too-big-to-fail problem, there's no reason to have the Volcker rule anymore. So I would be in favor of repealing it.
On too-big-to-fail, you talk about replacing Title II with the new bankruptcy chapter. What do you mean exactly?
This is a complicated issue, but I think that we need to do a combination of things that's different from Title II. So remember that Title II has this sort of liquidation authority, orderly liquidation authority built into it, where the FDIC is supposed to take over these very large institutions and somehow work them out very quickly and liquidate them very quickly. I don't think that's workable for a variety of reasons. I don't think that's going to work. What we really need is a combination of keeping them far away from this and then for institutions that aren't subject to those just to liquidate them. So if you're a small bank or small non-financial, a non-bank financial institution goes under or even medium-sized one, we just want to have a sort of hardwired liquidation of that. For the very large institutions, of course, we're going to have other rules that are going to keep them credibly far away from having to be liquidated. And then I have a third proposal which is related to this, which is to create our own version of an emergency assistance package, like what we did with TARP, that's sitting on the shelf. So if we really have another systemic crisis where we have to provide assistance on a systemic basis to banks, we already have argued about what that should be and how we're going to do it. And so a lot of people are critical of the bankruptcy plan because they say, oh, we need to have a flexibility built in. The key difference between my approach and their approach is I want to have that flexibility be something we've already legislated and have sitting on the shelf, not just be subject to the discretion of the Secretary of the Treasury and the head of the Federal Reserve to figure it out on an ad hoc basis as things evolve. I want to have a real systemic risk resolution plan already agreed. So I'm not arguing for that we just put everything through bankruptcy that happens. I'm arguing, yeah, if we have a real systemic risk, we're going to need flexibility. But let's build that in to a program that we legislate in advance. Let's not just leave that up to the discretion of bureaucrats.
All right. Now, this is a little technical, so I ask you to make it understandable for folks, but very interesting proposal. First of all, you want to simplify capital ratios, and obviously the amount of capital was critical. And you have this also this contingent convertible securities with,
right,
that has a market conversion trigger. Very interesting.
Well, that one is, I think, a pretty important proposal. And, look, everybody can understand, because especially this summer if you live in New York City, how important it is to have a thermostat, right? So when the temperature gets hot outside, inside it stays cool. Why? Because you've got a regulator sitting in your thermostat that says when you start to feel more heat, you turn on the air conditioning. And that's what market pricing can do for us. What we want is something that says when banks look like they're losing their economic value of their equity buffer, remember, the key thing is we want banks to have a limit on their leverage. But that's not just a bookkeeping thing. They have to actually have economic value of equity as a proportion of their assets. So that as the market value of banks fall, we want banks to go voluntarily into the market and raise more equity. This last crisis we lived through, there was a 2.5-year period where bank equity was falling. The crisis didn't happen in one moment in September, right? So there was plenty of time for banks to replace equity. They replaced a lot of equity, but not enough. And so what we need is something that's going to be a market-based signal that's going to make the banks want to voluntarily recapitalize themselves when they suffer losses. So that's what this COCO's plan, a contingent capital plan, would do. Banks would have to issue a lot of convertible debt, and if their market value of equity falls below, let's say, 10% of their market value of assets, measured very easily on a day-to-day basis, if that happens after, let's say, a certain moving average, so it's a nice smoothed over time thing, if that happens, then they get this huge conversion on a dilutive basis of this debt into equity, which, of course, stabilizes them immediately. But by putting it up at this high trigger, this has nothing to do with being insolvent. They're far from being insolvent. So they could easily go into the market when their equity ratio is, let's say, 11% and voluntarily issue equity to make sure that they never trip that 10% threshold. That's the whole point of it. How do you get them to do that? You make the dilution consequences of triggering so nightmarish for the CEO that the CEO will voluntarily, reliably go into the market and preserve that equity buffer, just like that thermostat that you have in your house. And so that's the whole argument. We need to have a very transparent, accountable, and dependable method for making too-big-to-fail banks stay far away from the insolvency threshold. My 10% trigger with a very dilutive conversion of contingent capital would accomplish that. And I've gotten a lot of support for this proposal. I think that this proposal makes a lot of sense.
It's brilliant, really, because the dilution incentive is such a will keep their focus on not having to use it.
Exactly the idea, exactly. And, you know, some of my friends, like Charles Goodhart, who's a famous banking economist in Britain, he wrote a paper saying, are cocos from cloud cuckoo land? Which is a British way of saying that he didn't like them. Okay, and then I agreed with him in his criticisms of those cocos, which are the cocos that actually exist in Europe as part of the regulatory apparatus. But then after my proposal, he wrote a Financial Times op-ed specifically endorsing my proposal. So I want to emphasize, if some people, some of your listeners, think they don't like coco plans based on the European regulation, I agree with them. But this is completely different. This is all about incentivizing the banks to stay away from insolvency, using this as a thermostat.
All right, we'll move from cocos to more reforms in our final national segment.
Do you have an old car sitting in your driveway? How would you like to learn a hassle-free way to get rid of it, help kids in need, and get a great tax donation in the process? It's real easy. One simple free call to our car donation hotline is all it takes. Call the Neshama Foundation at 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. We'll come pick your car up for free and give you a tax donation for the full value of the car, running or not. The value of your unwanted car will go to help kids in need. It's fast and easy. Just call us and your car will be gone and on its way to helping children in 48 hours. And you get a nice tax deduction. Call the Neshama Foundation now to get rid of your car, help kids, and get a tax write-off. Call 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. That's 800-721-6723.
Hi, I'm Joan London. If you're worried about your parent or loved one living alone, like I was, and you want reliable senior care information, then call A Place for Mom, the nation's largest senior living referral service.
Finding an apartment that was on the courtyard with the view of the trees, the view of the ducks, the stream, the creek, all of that, that was what I needed.
You'll get free information on assisted living, Alzheimer's care, nursing homes, even important financial information. Here's the number.
To speak to a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-506-0320. That's 800-506-0320.
A Place for Mom is a free service, and you can trust them to help you. So if you're struggling to find reliable senior living information, there's a place for answers, A Place for Mom.
To speak to a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-506-0320. That's 800-506-0320.
How old are you? 25, 35, 50, or older? If you have pain, we can help. Do your knees hurt?
Ow!
Let me ask you again. Are your knees killing you?
Oh, yeah. Are they ever?
What about your back? When you bend over, does it feel like this? How about when you get out of bed in the morning? If you're like me, your knees and back feel like this.
Oh, that hurts.
I found a company called the Pain Relief Hotline. They specialize in ways to treat your knee, back, and neck pain without surgery or taking medications. The good news is if you have insurance, you may have little or no cost or out-of-pocket expense. I've used them. It works. Call the Pain Relief Hotline now for free information. 800-303-4607. 800-303-4607. Call now. 800-303-4607. That's 800-303-4607.
Here's George Foreman with InventHelp.
Hi, I'm George Foreman. Do you have an idea for a new product or invention? People ask me all the time, George, how do I get my idea in front of companies? How do I get a patent? What do I do next? Do you have the same questions? I'll tell you like I'll tell them all. Call my friends at InventHelp.
Call InventHelp today for free information. InventHelp has been helping inventors for more than 30 years and has sales offices nationwide. InventHelp can submit your invention to companies companies who are interested in receiving new ideas. If you have an idea and want to try to patent it and submit it to companies, you should call InventHelp today for free information.
Listen, I can't guarantee a company will be interested in your idea, but I believe every inventor deserves the opportunity to step into the ring and take their best shot. Put InventHelp in your corner.
To get your free inventor's information, call 1-800-351-1453. That's 1-800-351-1453. Again, 1-800-351-1453.
This alert just came in. This special announcement is for business owners and leaders of organizations who've been waiting for the right time to build. General Steel has made it impossible to wait any longer with rock-bottom prices that could save you thousands. That's right, General Steel, America's leader in pre-engineered structures, is offering buildings at prices you will never see again. Don't miss these prices. A 50 by 100 for under $30,000. You heard right. That's 5,000 square feet under $30,000. Manufacturers, if you need a larger building, try a 100 by 100 commercial building for $129,000. You can't afford to rent with these prices. Imagine a 70 by 100 foot church building for under $69,000. With the economy improving and interest rates still at historic lows, you can't afford to wait.
Call 800-605-5370. 800-605-5370. Call 800-605-5370.
Biz Talk Radio.
We're back with Charles Calamaris, the Henry Kaufman Professor of Financial Institutions at the Columbia B School. I want to talk about some big reforms now. What do we do with Fannie, Freddie, FHA, the FHLBs? What do we do with them?
Well, I'm a radical on this topic. As you know, my view is we want to subsidize affordable housing using down payment matching assistance that's targeted toward the poor and some other things. Savings account subsidies, and that sort of thing. We do not want to subsidize mortgage risk. And so we want to get rid of all these institutions. We want to get rid of Fannie and Freddie, the FHA, the Federal Home Loan Banks. We just want to phase them out because they're not doing what we need. They're not making housing more affordable. They're making it riskier. So that's a very hard thing to do because a lot of people like boosting home lending, especially mortgage brokers, especially home builders. And you will find that, you know, Dodd-Frank created some standards for making sure risk in mortgages was reduced. And as Barney Frank said, the way that things were implemented became what he called the loophole that ate the standard. In other words, the politics of combination, and it's not just the mortgage brokers and the builders, it's also urban activist groups and others that benefit from some of these risk subsidies. That what's happened is that all of them conspired to dilute and to get rid of the effectiveness of those limits on mortgage risk. So we need to go in a different direction. We need to think about really targeting assistance to the poor and not subsidizing risk. So we need to get rid of them.
Would Fannie and Freddie become private entities, you know, with stocks, et cetera, or you're just going to wipe them out?
You know, there are many different ways to get rid of them, but I think what you have to do is make sure that you get rid of them in a way that doesn't just reestablish the status quo as of 2002, which means you can't just reestablish Fannie and Freddie as private entities. You have to, you know, sell off the portfolios, make this much more of a fragmented market. There's just no reason to have a Fannie and Freddie in the marketplace anymore. Yeah. Now, some people will say to me, oh, wait a minute, you know, we need a single homogeneous mortgage platform, la, la, la. I don't agree with that, but I don't want to fight every battle. So I would say there are other models. Denmark is one of the most successful ones for how to create some kind of standardization and management of market risks through a government-implemented program without having the government subsidizing risk or bearing risk in the system. So I just want to point out there are other ideas for creating platforms for getting some of the benefits that have come with Fannie and Freddie. But the point is we do not need to have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We do not need to have any kind of government absorption of the risks of mortgages. That's not necessary, and it's very counterproductive. It's really been a source of most of our problems in the mortgage market.
Interesting. Now, SIFIs, systemically important financial institutions, what should happen to SIFI? And you know, you see the impact of GE basically having to divest all of GE Capital to get
right.
to get unlisted.
Well, here again, you know, the courts have challenged the FSOC, the Financial Stability Oversight Council's definitions of SIFIs, and they've tried to, you know, argue that MetLife should be one, but the courts threw that out because there was no basis in reality for that decision. So I think the answer is, and not everyone of my friends agrees with this idea, I think we should preserve the SIFI designation. But I think that it has to be a consequence of some kind of characteristics that are observable. So, for example, if you're a very large insurance company or investment bank or some other kind of financial institution, and you're involved in funding yourself with a lot of short-term debt, then maybe that should qualify you as a SIFI. That is, the combination of being sufficiently large and relying on to a sufficient degree on short-term funding.
Interesting.
But if you don't rely on short-term funding, then that should be a safe harbor.
Like an insurance company.
Exactly. So if you can demonstrate that your liquidity risk based on your funding structure is sufficiently low, then I don't think you should be a SIFI. So I don't think it should just be that we give unlimited discretion without any kind of explanation to a government agency, because that's going to be abused. We've learned that from Dodd-Frank over the past several years, that unlimited discretion is being abused. And we need to become more formulaic. Now, some people will object, oh, well, the formulas could be wrong. Well, human beings can be wrong. And the difference is that formulas aren't corrupt.
How would you consolidate regulatory structures?
My own view on this is that the Federal Reserve should not be, because it's the central bank, it should not be the primary regulator of banks. And I think that we do need to consolidate things. Ironically, in early 2008, the Treasury Department had issued a white paper, which I think was excellent, talking about how to consolidate regulation, and I basically endorsed that plan, which would create a single bank regulator instead of the multiple bank regulators we currently have, and place that authority largely outside the Fed as a single entity. The Fed would still have unlimited examination and supervision authorities and participation, because it needs to as a lender of last resort, but it wouldn't be the main locus of regulation and supervision. And then we wouldn't have an OCC, a Fed, an FDIC. Mm-hmm. We would just have one agency that's involved in the supervision and regulation of banks for the most part.
I think that
makes sense.
Common sense. Would you have a federal charter for insurance companies?
Yes. You can see that we need this from a health care standpoint, that we need competition across states in insurance, but that's very true also for life insurance and other things.
Okay, we're down to the last minute. Now we got to live in the real world. Lobbying has totally distorted Washington. Campaign finance has given disproportionate power to the big firms, et cetera. What do we do there to even have a chance of your stuff being looked at?
The Republicans, for the first time, put out this in the House, Speaker Ryan, a better way. And they elevated rule of law and reform for the first time to a pillar that was central to their platform. And now we also have Donald Trump in the White House. And a lot of Democrats are maybe rightly concerned that Donald Trump isn't, let's say, dedicated to preserving rule of law as much as they would like. And so the combination of Speaker Ryan's enthusiasm for this and the fact that maybe the Trump presidency, and I'm not trying to criticize the president, just saying maybe that will make Democrats also think that due process is something that they'd like to see more of. That's the optimistic note, that somehow we might be at a point where, having seen these problems, we might even be able to do this on a bipartisan basis.
Thanks to Professor Calaveras. That was a fast hour. There's a lot of brilliant insights in this, along with common sense. That book, which packs a lot of stuff in only about 60 pages, very readable, understandable, Reforming Financial Regulation After Dodd-Frank. Get it on Kindle. It's an e-book. It's 99 cents. It's pretty good value there. This has been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to Charles Calamiris. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see everybody next Sunday on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.
The opinions you hear on Biz Talk Radio are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Biz Talk Radio, its management, or advertisers. The information on Biz Talk Radio does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions about Biz Talk Radio, contact us at 817-274-1609 or at biztalkradio.com.
Biz Talk Radio,